5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, flow.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that. Thanks, Major Tom. Hello, and welcome to another episode of AnnaZone 23. I'm Rick.
And I'm Drew.
And on this week's episode, we thought with the recent release of Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0, or as some people are calling it, End of Eva 2 Electric Boogaloo, we would take a look back at where, although that is now a Studio Kara production, and we do like to remember the name Gainax on this show. And the show we are discussing today, Gunbuster, is where really where Gainax for the first time intersected with the giant robot genre.
And it's also notable because Gunbuster has been announced is going to be coming out yet again in Blu-ray sometime in the next year or so.
Yes, there is that. There's also been the news that apparently Aim for the Top 3 is in production. I don't remember which studio that's supposed to be. Because I know it's not Kara, because Anno has no interest in it, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, well, a lot of things. It's an interesting combination of things that put that got Gunbuster coming out. Because when we left Gainax, they were basically scraping by, doing other people's work, trying to run general products, and trying to save a couple of dimes so they could do their own projects again.
Yeah, it is an interesting time for them, because this comes out in 1988, which puts it, if I remember correctly, this is post Royal Space Force, our last time that we spoke about. It's post Royal Space Force.
Oh yeah, this is post Royal Space Force. It's post Appleseed.
Oh, that's right, they did
also post Appleseed.
I always forget they do Appleseed.
Remember, Appleseed is their wilderness years when they're trying to make
that's
money.
That's their commission
again.
Work.
Appleseed probably helped.
Yeah,
pay for this.
Appleseed is. We have to remember that Appleseed's technically the first OVA that they've done, and that one is essentially it was a commission job, from what I understand.
Yeah, correct. And there are a couple other things they did commission work on. So this was when they could finally get enough money together to try again. So Okada and the central team, including Anno, all got together and started writing. It was a real team effort. It is interesting because they would have been working in about 1987 or so. And at that point, it's interesting because a fairly famous and very famous and multiple Hugo and Nebula award-winning American science fiction author was starting to work on a movie about giant robots, which is not a common thing to be done in American movies. But at that point, Joe Haldeman, most famous for a book we're going to talk about, but has won several awards for his fiction, especially his short stories, got drafted by a buddy of his to write a story about giant robots. He wrote a fairly serious story about proxy wars fought by champions with bits of the Trojan War mixed in. Unfortunately, the guy who was directing it is a guy who cut his teeth doing a fairly darkly humorous Lovecraft story about zombies. The guy who did Reanimator. Mm-hmm. And so he essentially turned his semi-serious take on what would have been a predecessor to Gundam G, pretty much, into, the closest thing I could say is it's like Death Race 2000 with giant robots, but without Roger Corman's over-the-top sense of humor. And that movie was called Robot Jocks. And famously, Haldeman did not really come out of that feeling very good about himself for a number of years. It really, he said, it was like your he's like one of your kids dying almost. But what's interesting is he was working on this at exactly the same time as the Gainax guys are shipping into their work, and they decide to go to the giant robot bin, but they also go to the Shoujo bin, and they also go to the American Blockbuster bin. And then, in fact, when I heard Okada talk about this at Otakon, he basically said, "I put in everything I could think of into this movie." And it shows. There are bits and pieces of all sorts of references, all sorts of weirdness. It's kind of
it's a very wild mix. Robot Jocks is a very different kind of movie. That's for sure. It's not a good movie. You might call it a gooder movie.
It's the case of he got the wrong Lovecraft fan to direct it, but I don't think Del Toro was working in movies yet. So, you know, if Haldeman had been writing for Del Toro, hell, we might have gotten a really interesting giant robot thing before Pacific Rim.
True, that would have been.
But the Gainax guys decided to merge their giant robots with Shoujo sports analogies.
Yeah, because it's interesting because you look at the title and we all know it as Gumbuster, but it's not Gumbuster. It's Aim for the Top.
Top no Merede, to be precise. And the thing is, a lot of people don't know this because, and a lot of fans didn't know this, but no Neraide is Aim for, and Ace no Raio, Raini, Aim for the Ace, is a famous shoujo tennis manga and anime from the 70s. And they borrow an awful lot of the, we have the rookie who can't do anything right, the snippy bitchy girls, the older sibling, the hard as nails coach who sees potential in her. And they also grabbed a fair amount of Top Gun, which is why it's Top no Nerede. Or Neraide.
It's interesting because actually that's a good analogy too, especially with, you know, they're taking the Top Gun, because you have to remember about Top Gun is everyone's like, oh, it's a military. Top Gun's not a military movie. It's a sports movie with fighter jets
and volleyball.
Well, I said it was
a and sports singing. Movie. Yeah. Have been discussing.
So what you're saying is
the hidden sexual content.
You could argue
if you think that Shoujo has a bit of subtext, people have been talking about Top Gun subtext.
So what you're
for
saying
years.
Is that you could argue if you're careful, you could argue that Gunbuster has more in common with Prince of Tennis than it does with Mazinger.
Most definitely, because it's a strange giant robot show, and that will come around later, because we open and we have, well, we basically have Project Echo. We have schoolgirls learning to pilot giant robots, which is something we saw all the way back in Project Echo, and it hasn't been that common since then. It's not common to have, you know, they're usually super special military weapons or built by mysterious scientists,
or they're here, or they're it's they're emotionally class. Maladjusted young boys.
Yeah, and usually they're emotionally maladjusted young boys. Here we have emotionally maladjusted young girls, but we'll get to that in a minute, because our heroine Noriko is the clumsy. We see from the contents of her room that she's into, you know, dreaming big, and has probably been dreaming of piloting a robot for years, but she doesn't seem to have the talent for it, or at least she gets distracted very easily and doesn't seem to be able to do much. However, the coach, who knew her father back when the aliens encountered the humans, and he barely escaped and her father died, he sees potential in her. as the partner for One-sama, Big Sister, who is the star of the robot team. And only two of these girls are going to be selected for the initial project. And Big Sister is going to be one of them. And the question is Noriko going to be the other one? That's episode one.
That's the big, that's really how it starts off. The other thing to remember is that these are slightly longer by a couple minutes than your standard TV episode, 25 to 29 minutes.
They're pushing 35, I think, in some cases.
They're listed as 25 to 29. Mm. But that's one. I mean, honestly, there's one thing I have as kind of a criticism of this, and less so of its sequel, Diebuster, which we'll talk about a little bit later. In another show, we will focus on that one, but I'm going to bring it up here, is they're dense. Each episode is, it feel like you just brought up, it's like, well, probably 35. They feel longer than they are. Not in a bad way, necessarily, but they're very densely plotted.
They have that trademark Gainax, we saw and read every science fiction book and movie you've ever heard of, and we're going to put in small references to everything you see. And that's not even kind of science lessons they tack on at the end of the episodes, where they try to explain some of the science of how their world works and mention things like Tannhauser gates. Some of the later science episodes were done after, which were done for the Laserdisc release, which was, I think, in 92-ish or 93-ish. We also have Noriko dressing up as Sailor Moon and various other Sailor Scouts when discussing the planets. So this, they actually did some of them like 5 years on. So if you ever wonder why those, it's like, how does that match up? It's like, this series had legs and it took a long time to get done. But yes, Big Sister Kazumi is, you know, she's elegant. She looks 2 or 3 years older than her. She's like 17 or 18. She looks about 23, maybe 25. Elegant, beautiful. Noriko looks like a teenager, an awkward teenager who gets bullied, but is in really fit shape. So we basically have the first episode is really a pair is where the real parallels.
Yeah, that's the school episode.
Because it's the school episode, and it famously ends with the great big lightning kick to the face of her rival that basically signs her ticket to go out into space.
There's two lightning kicks that are always remembered in anime. The first is Char's. The second is Noriko's. Because every single time you see someone doing a kick like that, it's referencing one of those two things.
Oh, the other thing that has to be mentioned is that there are lots of scenes that you've seen in lots of other anime about girls being bullied by other girls. However, Noriko is the only one to walk away from the other girls, humping and, well, jiggling.
Yes, audience, this is the origin of there's Gainaxing.
Yeah. Yes. This is also why you'll sometimes hear Gunbuster referred to as Bust Gunner or various other terms. Gainax really went in with the breast physics, which is interesting because there's a fair amount of fan service, but overall it's done strangely, and it's only in some of the episodes, but we'll get back to that in a bit later. So episode two is the, hey, we're in space. Hey, it's time to meet our rival. And the rival happens to look a lot like another character from Aim for the Ace. She's smart, snippy, arrogant, foreign, redheaded. And her name is Jung Freud.
And the thing to note is that she's the Soviet pilot.
Yeah, folks. Soviet pilot. Yeah, it's like,
well, I mean, she could always be West German, or not, sorry, not West German, East German.
East German. She's often considered to have been East German, just be Soviet bloc. But yeah, Jungfreud, and she is snippy, and she immediately challenges Onesama to a little duel.
She basically goes prison rules. She looks for the, you know, she immediately looks for the top person and then challenges them.
Yeah.
You're gonna, you know the old joke. You find the toughest looking, you when you go to prison, you get to find the toughest looking guy and beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, and that's basically pretty much how Jung works. And it's a draw. They get in a little bit of trouble because they get caught, you know, sneaking out of bounds to have a fight. And after that, Jung is much nicer to them. And they have a little bit of female bonding in the steam bath. Why do we call her Jungfreud? Well, one, Anna will eventually go into psychotherapy. And I'm sure he knew a fair amount about it before that. So that's likely reason one. Reason two is that Tomino hadn't... The other reason is Tomino had dibs on full
One of the things that I do find interesting about all this, and I mentioned this early on, is I'm not sure how interested Anno is anymore with basically the whole Evangelion thing, because we know Evangelion's his baby. But Gunbuster was directed by Anno.
Mm-hmm. But it was written by Okada and others as well.
Yeah, it was
kind of game we're going to get into that. Yamaga. Yeah. And Okada says that, you know, at first Amano was kind of like, you know, I'm just the director and such. He said somewhere about episode 2 he sort of took over.
That would explain how it cuz the weird thing about Gunbuster is it doesn't, when you watch the first episode especially, it doesn't seem like it's going to be an epic by any means.
By no means. And especially halfway through the second episode, the three girls are sitting naked as jaybirds. That's why I said they couldn't use full frontal because Tomino already had dibs on the name. But you could call Jungfreud full frontal. You get to see, you practically know her religion by the time you're done with that scene. There's some serious fan service in that scene, is all I'm saying. But then it's like, okay, we've introduced our rival character. We've had a fight. So what are we going to do next? Oh, we have to do a mission. So it's time to go out in the kind of medium big robots and intercept a ship. And the thing is, they don't tell Noriko about it, but it's her father's ship, which has finally made it back to Earth after almost 20 years or 10 years. I think she died. I think she was like 9 or 10 when he died. So it's been like 10 years, and the ship has finally reached the Earth. But it's been going by at near relativistic speed, that is, near the speed of light. So that ship is only 3 days after the fight that Coach barely survived. And we're like, wait a minute, you guys have been doing schoolgirls shenanigans, throwing fan service left and right. What the heck did you get it to put in real physics?
Yeah, that's one that's already that, like, that's kind of where you kind of go, wait, what?
Oh, what? Yeah, and you're like, you're doing physics and you're doing the Forever War, for gosh sakes, which is one of the most serious stories you can do with time dilation. That is Haldeman's, you know, breakout book, his first sci-fi book. Won the Hugo and the Nebula. It's basically a memoir of Vietnam set back into space. It's very relevant to how they're going to be doing the story. So Noriko suddenly has a chance to maybe find her father. Of course, that means the mission goes completely off the rails. They eventually catch up with her, grab her, and get her back on the rocket sled. But instead of getting back in a week, they get back in 3 months. And they're like, welcome back. Jung and Noriko apparently share a birthday. And Jung's like, sorry, had my birthday without you. Because they were planning to throw a party together. And then Noriko just breaks out sobbing and runs out. And you're like, wait a minute, you know, we were doing Top Gun and tennis anime, and now we're in Forever War territory. You know, what the heck gives? But this is how Gainax works.
Basically, what sort of set it, like their kind of their style.
It's, we will do a generic story of type A, as good or better than anybody else, but then we'll do our own thing with it. And it really starts to show in episode 3, because episode 3 is when I think that you really start to get a sense of how Anno wants to direct this.
Yes.
There's some pretty interesting shots in 2, but in 3, the difference between Anno's direction and, say, Royal Space Force's direction is that Anno has no fear. Anno will do ridiculous things that may come off as incredibly silly to try to get us to feel something sometimes. But the man has no fear in his direction. He'll do weird camera angles. He'll shoot a scene differently. He'll put in weird details. It just happens that way. But it also puts an awful lot of emphasis on his interpersonal stories. And he shoots them with almost as much interest as he shoots his fight scenes. You don't have a lot of over-the-shoulder, you know, one head talking to the left, one head talking to the right scenes. Usually you have both characters in frame, sometimes framed in a weird way.
He does a lot of things that up until this point, there hasn't been a whole lot. He likes to make the viewer feel uncomfortable, I've noticed.
Yeah, he does that too. And I'll get to that a bit, because the way his sub bit is to make the viewer uncomfortable about certain things, because that's kind of where I think one of the themes of his story. But we'll get to that when we go a little bit over how the story is going, because Volume 3 is Noriko's low point. They're out on the battleship now with all the other pilots, and Big Sister Kasumi is, like, not sure she trusts Noriko to be her co-pilot, so Noriko is kind of working with another pilot that she met during there's a game where they have a dare to walk out during hyperspace jump, because hyperspace is scary in this universe, which is kind of, that's more CJ Cherith than any other story I can think
of. It's wild, the amount of just hard sci-fi that they pull from in this.
Yeah, it's wild because most of the characters are pretty perfunctory, but the themes and ideas, it's like, man, you got bits and pieces of 20 different stories. By the way, her boyfriend / partner / whatever is named Smith Torin, after Torin Smith, who was working at Gainax at this point. He had done some manga translation. He'd done some fan work back in the States. He'd been married to another fan back in the States or in Canada in his earlier life. By this point, he was trying to make it as an animator. He was famously living with like 3 or 4 other animators in a house that was so messed up. When they left, they apparently tore it down and rebuilt it. But he also picked up his wife at this point. And as the joke goes, Smith Torin in Gunbuster has way more hair than Torin Smith ever had, because he's got one of those big dandelion poof jobs. And Torin Smith famously had about as much hair as Jake. Sorry, Jake.
Sorry, buddy,
but yeah, you look a bit like Torin Smith, Jake, which is probably a good thing for an anime fan, except you're bigger than he was. Anyhow, this is kind of the low point for everything, because this is where Anno says, you think it'd be cool to be in a giant robot and be out in space fighting aliens? Be terrifying. It'd be like trying to read stereo directions so you can't get killed while you're in the dark and the silence. and you can't even see what's going on. You can't process half of what's going on. And Noriko just has a terrible time in her first space battle. She spends the beginning of it traumatized. She ends it traumatized. It's a frightening scene.
Wild, how this whole thing, like, Gunbuster for me is one of those interesting ones where it's. I always have a hard time describing Gunbuster.
Gunbuster is weird. Gunbuster plays with some of. We have the first fight, which basically has some stakes. And then suddenly turns on a dime and one lightning kick and our hero and wins.
Yeah.
We have no real fights. We just have an angst moment in two. Three, we have the scariest battle there ever is. And finally in four is basically when Noriko finally grows up or accepts her fate, you might say, would be a better description.
Yeah, she basically embraces her, I guess you could say embrace her destiny kind of thing.
It's embrace your destiny. And this is the kind of universe. It's not like the Ava universe where it might be the gods are testing us. Here are the indifferent universes trying to kill us. But once she decides that she is going to pilot, every fight we see is a curb stomp.
Yeah.
Because once Gunbuster is unleashed, she is calling her attacks. She's killing thousands to millions of aliens with her every gesture. So the fight in so four is like the slow build to the big reveal moment of the big robot. And Gunbuster didn't sell that many toys. It's never sold that many toys. But it's suitably enormous. The end of four, Noriko and Big Sis, you know, they're triumphant. And then we get to five, and it's like, okay, now it's round two with the aliens. It's been a little while, and now we're going to steal another title from Sci-Fi, and we're going to really push the buttons for how it's going to be for the girls. Because we've already had one scene in four where they went back to Earth, and they had a graduation ceremony, and it's been like 5 to 6 years on Earth, at least.
Yeah, like the it's kind of a case of whenever they play with the time dilation, it starts out small, mm-hmm. and then they keep basically it's bigger and bigger jumps.
Yep, the first jump is about 6 years because your Noriko is basically wandering around their town after, you know, they're just there to pick up their diplomas, basically, that's all. And she looks around and suddenly she's walking up a set of steps and this woman walks past her, and suddenly the girl turns around and we recognize her. It's her best friend from high school, who is now 6 years older than her, and is, as we find out, is married and has a kid. Whereas Noriko looks exactly the same as she did in episode one.
Gee, this is something that gets played out in one of Anno's later works.
Yeah, he does. He does play a little bit.
Not so much Ava, the TV series, as in the Resurrection movies.
Movies, yeah, the three movie he plays into this a bit. But this is very reminiscent of the Forever War, because the Forever War, it's like they do their first couple missions. They do their first deployment, and they come back from that, and it's been 20 years. And then they do another deployment, and it's been 200 years. And then the last deployment is going to be like 700 years. And the Earth is becoming more and more unrecognizable as they keep coming back to it. And less and less of, why the heck are we fighting for this place? But for her, this is strange. But what else is happening is that the role between Big Sis and Noriko is reversing. All of five is basically is seeing Kazumi lose her. Kazumi's dominant role fades out because she has still has a crush on Coach, their instructor, who's
trying to think. Is five the episode where she has her freak out?
Yes. It's where she has her freak out because they're out on a mission. Coach is back on Earth. Slowly dying of radiation poisoning.
And the, like the time that I remember this because it was the first scene from Gunbuster I ever saw. It was at an anime convention. It was actually our friend Bear. He was running Super Robot Wars and talking about like giant, you know, super robots, right? And he got to Gunbuster and he showed the scene with Takaya's
Nozomi.
Nozomi's freak out.
Yeah. She's convinced Coach is going to be dead and gone by the time she gets back and everything. And she's, you know, she's 19 years old. She looks older, but she's a 19-year-old girl on her first big crush. And it's just making a mess of her. And Noriko's there basically to do the Edna mode, get yourself together.
Yeah, that's the first scene I remember ever seeing of Gunbuster.
Buster. Yeah, that one, again, most of the show, as I said, is a riff on the Forever War, but that particular episode is called Time Enough for Love, which is the name of a Robert Heinlein book, actually. So, yeah, they're showing off their nerd cards in a big way. And then you get, so it's like, okay, they've, you know, started out small. They become the heroes. They've saved the world twice from ever bigger infestations of Lovecraftian alien creatures. You know, what are you going to do next? And then the sixth episode opens and it's in black and white. And it opens on Kazumi on Earth looking about 30-something, give or take. Probably just a bit past 30. She's been teaching at their old school, as has the bully from the first episode. She became the gym coach. But she's called back to ride the Skyhook back up to orbit and rejoin the Exilion, which is the big battleship. Or the Exilion 2, which is the new big battleship, because they blew up the old last.
We'll get to that because we'll talk about the Buster machines.
Yeah. Buster machines. Yeah, it's like, okay, so what are we going to do now? Well, we've built this bomb out of the planet Jupiter, and we're going to go to the center of the galaxy and blow up a quarter of the galaxy. So hopefully these bugs will leave us alone.
Yeah, so the Starship Troopers starts coming up.
It's even beyond Starship Troopers. This is up at Lensman levels. This is Lensman levels. You're just like, holy cow. And the thing is, she gets up there. She gets onto the ship. And there are Jung and Noriko looking all of 20 years old, if that. Bright and chipper and happy as ever. Well, Noriko's really happy until she gets a letter from her best friend. Basically, I know they're only taking a certain number of people off the Earth if anything happens. Can you please get my daughter off the Earth, if it's at all possible? And she gets a greeting from the daughter, who's maybe 3 years younger than her now. All of which really kind of messes up Noriko a little bit more. So Noriko and her now much bigger sis go off to fight the final battle. Jung yields co-piloting job to Kazumi, not without being really irritated about it, because, well, Jung's irritated about everything. By the way, Jung's voice actress will have a small role in Evangelion. A rather small role, but a notable role. You know what role she plays, right, Rick? She's Asuka's mother.
Well, in a way, she kind of is.
Yes. Well, I always said that Asuka is younger for
life. Yeah.
You know, there's a definite line to be drawn between the two characters. And in fact, when they made a Mahjong side game, when Jung and Asuka meet, because Noriko is meeting Shinji, and they're both similar characters, then Asuka and Jung meet, and they decide that they will pilot Buster Machine number 2 together. But that's a little side story. So they're off to the center of the galaxy, and they have to blow up Jupiter in the right place, and they're fighting literally uncountable creatures, again, in black and white, sometimes in still frames. And by the way, this wasn't for money savings. It actually cost more to film to do it monochrome than
it would have been. You got to do extra stuff when you're doing monochrome considerations, because, like,
as we said, Anno was utterly fearless.
Like, a good point is to think about anime. You almost always have to simplify from, if it's based on manga, you almost always have to simplify the art, because most mm-hmm. manga art is too detailed. But the reason why manga art's that detailed is because you don't have color to differentiate things. So for things that have proper depth, you have to do shading with black and white.
There's some probably wild closer stuff,
honestly, to Aha's Take On Me video, which is, like, you know, what, 3.5 minutes?
It's about 2 minutes in a 3.5 minute video.
Yeah.
And it's rotoscoped. Boom.
Yeah, this is not they're doing the same thing, but without the rotoscoping.
Right. And they're ripping off, and Aha are only ripping off Altered States.
Yeah.
God only knows what the heck Gainax are ripping off. I can't name all the movies. But again, they get to the place, but the bomb, there's no Earth or Jupiter shattering kaboom. The bomb isn't working. So the girls have to take the Buster Machine, which is an enormous giant robot, we're talking several hundred feet tall, into the guts of this bomb, which again is, about the size of the moon. It's Jupiter squeezed down to the size of the moon, so it's rather dense, which makes it a bomb, to trip off the bomb, which they do by using one of their two power plants that are built into the machine, because Gunbuster is a two robots into one machine. And this is a scene that kind of is infamous in the movie, but it also, I think, it's indicative of how Anno and Gainax in general are approaching this show, because Noriko has to rip the power plant out of the chest of the Gunbuster machine and shove it into the bomb.
Yeah.
And she literally rips her top open doing this, which is a disturbing bit of fan service. Yes, because
you can tell it's very lovingly animated.
And sometimes you're also like, good God, did she rip her actual heart out? No, she didn't. But it came close. It's symbolic,
Drew.
It's very symbolic.
I'm not 100% sure, but...
Yeah, it's... The dial has been turned up. Gainax has set the thing up. We got the dialed and we turned it all the way up.
It's kind of like, as an audience, we're going on what, the horny meter?
No, because it's too disturbing to make it really horny. That's true. Just like, yeah, that's the thing is, for as much fan service as there is in the show, a lot of it is actually designed to disturb you in little
It does
ways.
Do that.
It to make you a little bit uncomfortable. Which is probably intentional because of what they're trying to do about the characters. But again, so their mission succeeded. But by doing that, they're not going to catch the bus home. They're not going to get back to Earth for 10,000 years. They're going to get back to Earth. It's only going to be about, 6 months for them, because they have a faster-than-light robot. But they don't have warp capability. So they got to take the long way home.
Important thing to acknowledge is that most of the time when you're looking at pop sci-fi and they're doing faster than light travel, they're not actually doing faster than light travel. Anime is real good about this. Most FTL in anime is either warp or some kind of space-time folding.
Yes.
Where it's...
And the ships do space-time folding, but they also travel at relativistic speeds in between their folds.
They acknowledge that that standard FTL and space warp are not the same thing.
Right. In the Forever War, they also acknowledge a similar thing of your time dilation came moving between black holes, because you basically went into what he called them collapse stars.
Yeah, they're black holes.
You jump into one black hole and pop out another one if you went in at the right angle.
Or some people might be more familiar with, you can think it of as like wormholes.
Yeah, Wormholes. This is a continuation of it. Remember, Forever War is from like 74, 73. Yeah, Wormholes aren't really
thought of quite yet.
Yeah, it's a ways back. But the last time we see Jung, she's realizing that she's been reduced to a supporting character, and she promises that they'll be there. She'll be there to welcome them back. And then we get to the last scene, and they're approaching the Earth, and it's dark, and it's kind of empty. And then the lights come on, and then the color comes in, and half the audience is crying. You could get some really tough otaku to cry. You know how the Disney equivalent of What Did You Cry was when Bambi's mother got shot? The otaku equivalent is, did you cry at the end of Gunbuster? It's like, if you say no, somebody might say, I don't want to know you, man. Yeah, just go away. You know, that is one of the big emotional moments. That is real space opera, you know, weepy space opera. Cry, damn and you,
it's
cry.
Interesting because that ending scene will be shared later.
Yeah, we'll see it from another angle in Die Buster, which is interesting, but it's also by Gainax, but it's a proto-Trigger.
Yeah, there's a very, even though it's a sequel, there is a very, and when we get my wife on the show, we'll talk about Die Buster more in depth.
It's, the difference is that the Trigger, the stuff that led into Trigger is about Gunbuster, and to a certain extent Evangelion, are about dealing with what is forced upon you. The difference is that the universe doesn't care, but is beatable in the case of Gunbuster. And we're not sure what the heck the universe is thinking in Evangelion, because they just might be testing or they might be assholes. Given some of the stuff that Haldeman's written, because several of his books end with aliens doing mysterious things to characters' loved ones as tests. Let's just say Haldeman likes his Gainax endings. Because Haldeman did his own Gainax endings before Gainax did their Gainax endings. He has a thing about the aliens being inscrutable and testing us. The Trigger shows are about characters who don't fit in but have all kinds of confidence. Because in the Gainax show, it's about finding the confidence to do something. In a Trigger show, it's figuring out how to turn this incredible confidence into something useful. Because you may be completely overconfident or unaware of what you're really good at. Or you need to learn to deal with other people so you have a team. Because, you know, team gives it somebody else to get shot at while you're working. And that's very much how Die Buster works. Because Die Buster's heroine is an incredibly confident, if incredibly naive, robot. Has something along the lines several other shows about superpowered robots it's from that time.
It's
got a lot of
it's the one thing that always stands out to me about the Gunbuster itself. So I think maybe we should just clarify here. We're talking about Gunbuster is actually only one of the machines.
Right. There are smaller machines.
The Sizzlers.
Which are Sizzlers. Sizzlers.
The Sizzlers are the midsize, and the RX-7s are the ones that we first see.
Yeah, the RX-7s are basically slightly larger than human-sized robots.
They're significantly larger. They're
20 feet tall.
Yeah, they're basically a step above power armor.
Yeah, they're one step up of plot. They're maybe one step up from Shiro's landmates.
For people that might be familiar with Mech Warrior, they would be light class.
Yeah, they're not very impressive overall. But the other thing is, as mech designs go, Gunbuster is pretty famous. I can't even remember what the Sizzlers are like. Mass production Sizzlers are Gunbusters.
Like they're like mass production Gunbusters. Like both they're larger scale production on smaller size, which is actually kind of a trend with a lot of anime involving robots. Is that like a good example? I think probably one of the best examples for me out of this is from Gundam Wing. And it's the relationship between the main antagonist, deutagonist. Basically, the Shar clone from that particular series pilots a suit called the Tall Geese. The Tallgeese is actually the prototype that the mass production Leo, which is what the main grunts use, is derived from. Anime has this weird thing where it's like, hey, let's take this. We're going to have this one-off prototype that's super overpowered. And then, like, we're going to have, like, the mass production type, which, oh, by the way, is not going to be as powerful as this prototype. I think a lot of anime creators understand that prototypes are for getting the bugs out, not for seeing what you can basically make less good.
Remember, Japan had a problem with mass producing anything during World War II. So the only things that looked really
cool were crazy minimum production stuff. Like
they didn't have quite the Wunderwaffen thing that the Germans had, but they had it pretty close.
Well, some of the things they got as a one off. You have to think about one of the most legendary Japanese weapons was not a one off, but the Yamato.
It was a two and a half off.
But then you also have things like, for example, the animators love using the Shinden for stuff.
Yeah, the Shinden looks freaking cool.
It does. I built
like three of them.
And it actually, apparently, if actually been able to produce any kind of number, it would have been a very potent aircraft. But the problem was it still had a lot of bugs.
Yeah. If it probably had the same problem that the P-57 had.
Very fast turn with a dam?
No, the biggest problem with having a pusher thing was getting enough air to the engine
there was a drawing of one with a jet engine.
Which would have been interesting too. And they had a few, the thing was, they were like working from German plans for the Junkers Yumo. And the Germans could barely make the Yumo at all.
Worth a damn.
And the Japanese, yeah.
But anyways.
So
the Gunbuster, which is the one thing that always strikes me about the Gunbuster, what is it, Gunbuster 1? Is that the robot? Because yeah. 2 is the ship. Like the Exelion is considered like Gunbuster 2.
Yeah, 3 is the bomb, and 4 is the one they use at the end.
Gunbuster 1, specifically the robot, always strikes me because it is so damn big.
Yes. But
to give you an idea, sometimes you go, I don't know if you can find it on Google, but if you Google like anime robot size chart, Gunbuster's since been superseded in terms of size, but at one point it was like the biggest robot.
Yeah, but it's always been like, you know, you have a Gundam, and a Gundam comes up to its
knees. No, not even its knees. It comes up to its, like, ankle.
I mean, yeah, Gunbuster's enormous. Like
Gundam, which the original Gundam was 18 meters, roughly.
Yeah, and I think like Gunbuster is close.
Gunbuster
is close to 200
meters. Yeah, the Gundam comes up to Gunbuster's ankle.
It's enormous. But again, the thing is, for a giant robot show, we have one scary fight that gets lost, and we have three curb stomp fights and a tragic victory fight. There isn't a lot of competition fighting in Gunbuster.
No.
The story is all on the characters. I mean, I haven't seen that many squash matches since, you know, a couple WrestleManias ago. You're not looking at really competitive fights.
It's
or building suspense. It's like when Noriko turns that light on, suddenly she becomes invincible.
It's all about the character.
It's all about the characters. Now the interesting thing, and I think that this is really worked in by Anno quietly, but I think it's there, is that he's making you aware of the sacrifice that is being required and eventually given, but not, you know, easily given, the sacrifice of what it costs our heroines to be the heroines. Because when the show ends, Noriko is that same otaku that we saw right at the beginning. She hasn't really had much of a life.
For her, if you really look at it, it's been the span of what?
And we've had these handful of scenes where we've seen her, we've seen her naughty bits in a couple of scenes, but we don't feel it's not really attractive. It's almost like impeding on her privacy.
Really, we're only seeing about a year or so,
maybe two at most. Right, and we don't even see the second year because we. pick it up 20 years on. You know, she said she and Jung could have done quite a bit in 1 year because being out in space, but we'll never know what that story was. They're never going to tell that story. But yeah, but the story is the story of what is, you know, what is given up, but it's told from the point of the people who give it up. And it's like, what do we owe them? We owe them everything. Fuck Geary. Fuck duty. We owe these people. Very non-Japanese, really.
It is kind of interesting. Well, but then again, Anno's always he doesn't, Anno and by extension, those older Gainax folks, never really, I wouldn't say their mindset is 100% your stereotypical Japanese mindset. They go against the grain quite a bit. Or at least they did.
They came out and, you know, they never grew out of being student radicals.
That's true. Types,
or just students. Or at least they didn't grow completely out of it for a long time. You know, I don't think they had enough energy to be revolutionaries. But they did do revolutionary things with their stories, which made it rather different. Now, the thing that we have to say about Gunbuster, was it a success? Oh, yeah. They made some serious dosh on this one because, you know, they actually owned a fair piece of it. But it didn't win that much in the way of merch. But from the American fandom perspective, it's kind of weird how Gunbuster fit in and has fit in over the years. Because Gunbuster was one of the very first anime to be localized for the U.S. But, remember who brought it out?
Genion, wasn't it?
U.S.
Renditions did the original one. U.S. Renditions did the original, and then later Bandai released it directly. I remember that was a long time later.
That was when DVD sets were coming
out. U.S. Renditions did the VHS.
As a set of his three tapes, $40 each. There wasn't that much buzz. There was a fair amount of buzz in the fan books for it. But the problem is, if you read a synopsis of Gunbuster, it sounds like a fairly generic giant robot show. Because in some ways it is. Also, U.S. Renditions was notorious for having horrible subtitles. Like, multiple typos. Typos galore in their subtitling. So you're spending $40 in 1990, figured nearly $100 a tape in today's money. And frankly, the first tape isn't that interesting. It just shows that it could get interesting.
No, because you really don't have any kind of hook until, what, episode 3?
You have a very late hook in episode 2. Because you're suddenly realizing, holy shit, we're doing time dilation. You put a time dilation in my fluffy, cute girls and giant robot show. What the heck gives? So, Gunbuster's been known for a long time. The other thing is, giant robot shows were not, as a percentage, that big of a deal in the 80s and 90s to the fandom. There were a fair number of Robotech fans, and there are a handful of Gundam fans. But, you know, there's a big difference between Gunbuster and Dangayo, or Voltron for that matter. But you have to have watched it to know what the difference is. So it had sort of what really saved it was anime got big enough that you could rent it from a tape rental place. That's how I first saw it. I went down to North Campus Video at OSU, and they had all three of them. So I could rent them for like $2 each. Instead of having to buy them for $40 each. And that makes a major difference. Over the years, you know, it became something that was like, yeah, okay, you're starting to become a serious fan. Okay, now we got to show you a serious robot show. This is not your daddy's giant robot show. And that was kind of, you know, it was something that you would introduce to people as they became further into fandom. And it became a lot easier after Bandai brought out the DVD version. But when we met Okada, it was summer of 94, I think. Yeah. Summer of 94. And, you know, we had a whole room of people. And I'd say 80% of us had seen Gunbuster. probably 90% of us had seen Nadia, and about 90% had seen Wings of Animes, because and Otaku no Video, for that matter. He had an audience of people who really appreciated his stuff. And as he said, you know, yeah, Gunbuster, he was kind of, because, but we always thought of Gunbuster as that really neat show that did weird things, but was so conventional otherwise. Because, in you know, the characters are rote in Gunbuster. The military guys, they like came, you know, they're very cliche.
They are very, very cliche.
They're very cliche. Their dialogue is very cliche. The world building isn't all that great. But the emotional sense is incredible. So, you know, we got, and that was pretty much what we got. Is like, yeah, I'm sorry about that. Some of it was, you know, I put in everything I could think of. Like, you know, why is it paced so badly? Because we didn't really know what we were doing and know how to cut it to get everything paced together the right way. And he made a few more remarks about it. But that was kind of the side thing, because that was like, yeah, these are the guys who did a giant robot show that was actually interesting. It was kind of how we thought about it. And as I said, at the end of the show, he's mentioned, oh yeah, and Anno's working on a new project, is working on a project now, having come out of therapy, which he'd gone into after basically killing himself making Nadia. And we're like, Anno, the guy who did Gunbuster, is doing something, you know, new? What could it possibly be? So we looked at Okada, was like, you know, well, what's it about? And Okada looked at us and smiled, and he said, shrugged and said, it's a giant robot show. Just like
Gunbuster, it wasn't a giant robot show at the same time.
Yeah, it was a giant robot show. Oh, it was.
Yeah, the timing on talking about Gunbuster, I feel, is very apt with the whole, you know, the fact that 3.0 plus 1.0 just came out. We'll talk about
Ava later. That was the thing. Gunbuster before Ava was a known show. It was a cult show. And it was considered important. It's still
considered important.
It's still considered really important, because now we have it, you can attach it to the through line to Ava and see, oh, this is where he was getting these ideas in working on them. And you can draw lines through it. But even before that had happened, we knew that it was like, these are guys who approached a pretty standard show and did weird things with it. But we didn't know where it was going, because, you know, Gainax only did interesting things every 3 or 4 years. And they, you know, were never hitting it quite as big. And they didn't have, you know, the sheer money that, say,
Bandai. It's interesting to talk about that, because they're the one that took over the distribution in the U.S. for DVD for Gunbuster. And the reason why I know this is because, or at the very least, they're the ones that got Diebusters. Because what's
No, they did the release for Gunbuster too. Yep. I think they were the original. I think they were the original Japanese.
All I remember is that either Gunbuster or Diebuster, we confused the hell out of Bandai, because the Japanese office had no idea what a anime club showing was. So eventually we're just like, we're just not going to say anything. Cause like, that was one of the first things I did as an officer of the Oshu Anime Club, is we put together at the end of my freshman year, a Gunbuster Diebuster marathon showing.
Yeah. I seem to remember that. I think I don't remember if I watched much of Diebuster that time. I have watched all of Diebuster at least once, but Gunbuster, I definitely checked.
Yes. It was the remastered R1 DVD box set in 2007. Mm-hmm. That was the one that Bandai did.
Yeah, and that, you know, everybody told everybody, it's like, it's $40. They're like, it's $40. It's like, it's 6 videos. It used to be cost $200.
Although we're starting to almost get back up to some of those levels.
Yeah,
we're for like a 12-episode, we're seeing like $100, $200.
Yeah, it can depend
for 12.
But Blu-ray is coming out, so.
Yeah, that's the big thing, is that there's going to be a new Blu-ray with a new dub too from Discotech.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody ever did a dub on it
because it's never been the original's never been dubbed before. Diebuster was dubbed. But that was from an era where basically you couldn't release something unless you dubbed it.
Yeah, pretty much. Whereas,
but that was basically an unwritten rule because throughout the, like,
Bandai was too cheap. Bandai was too cheap, or Gainax was not powerful enough to insist on getting a dub when it was brought back out. But yeah, Gunbuster is a weird, in a lot of ways, is a really odd piece of anime history because it fits into a continuity with Gainax really well. But as a giant robot show, it doesn't fit in. The only giant robot shows that the Gunbuster really connects to is Eva and a few of the Gainax shows, which are their own separate thing, and it's kind of the prototype for it. We're back at the Rocketeer versus the First
Avenger. It's kind of interesting because it's sort of a case of with Gunbuster, when you really break it down and look at it, and when you look at the studios that you could essentially say that Gunbuster spawned, which is Gaina, who's doing Aim for the Top 3. That's basically the continuation of Gainax as it existed. Mm-hmm. There's Studio Kara, which is Anno, basically. Yep. And then you have Trigger, which is essentially the later Gainax group.
It's the guys, it's like the younger crowd that
after
came in.
And basically after the boom that basically that were hired on because of the success of Ava.
Pretty much.
Because they're the ones that would have worked on Anno's Re-Cutie Honey and Die Buster and Gurren Lagann.
And probably Kari Kano.
You can see that
and
you can see it in, especially in, I think, Trigger's most recent film they came out with. I joked that when I saw it, that Promare was, Gunbuster 3 was great.
Promare
may not be like exactly Gunbuster, like it's its own thing. It's both its own thing and yet a blend of everything that's basically
got some of the sheer scale stuff that Gunbuster had, but it also has a lot of the Trigger stuff of, again, you have these crazy confident characters, and it's like, how do we get these characters to somehow succeed?
The one thing from Gunbuster, I think this is about what we'll wrap it up on, that I'll say is probably one of the most influential things of Gunbuster, besides everything else we've talked about, is the pose.
Yep. The bouncing bust line and the arms crossed across the chest, feet set shoulder width apart.
Just width apart. And defiant look on face.
Oh, and the other thing Gunbuster is famous for is that it brought back or pulled. It is the most throwbacky giant robot show in one way. Noriko calls all her attacks.
Yeah, because
it kind
of died out in you still had super robot shows in the 80s, but they were less common because, thanks to Gundam, the super robot show or the real robot show is getting more popular. Even some of the super robot shows, they weren't calling out their attacks 100% of the time.
Nope.
And then we Gunbuster, got the 90s boom of super robots after Gunbuster.
Oh, and the other thing that Gunbuster has, as we said during our Crusher Joe review, Gunbuster has eye catches for no particular purpose, where they say Gunbuster. And why they do this, don't know.
For those of you who've only watched anime in like a streaming context or in a or on DVD, those eye catches are where the commercial break is, because the way Japanese television set up is, what traditionally was been set up from what I understand, is you would have a commercial. You'd have commercials between the shows, and then you'd have the first half of the show, and then you'd have the second half of the show.
You would have the opening credits, quick commercial break, first half of the show, eye catch, which is the standalone eye catch, when commercial break, second half of the show, commercial break, and credits.
Yeah, the eye catch was there basically to make sure that you didn't miss the show. And actually, I found this out. That's how it's set up, not because of anime, but because of Sentai. Because unfortunately, the only way to watch Sentai for the longest time in the US was fan subs. And for some reason, unlike anime fan subs when they come up, even when they're brand new, even when you can find fan subs of shows that are currently airing, Sentai ones, for some reason, always have a clock in the top corner of the screen. So you hit the eye catch, and then it's like a 2 or 3 minute jump in time in the clock.
Well, I saw enough stuff that had been taped off of Japanese TV that I knew where the eye catches were and where the ads were, because they were in there. Now, when I have to admit, when Peter Payne and Shitane Masu were doing their fan dubs.
Oh, you mean the comedy fan dubs? I mean, they're usually just usually they're called a bridge series now because they're
a bridge.
They're also chopping up a bit now. It would just be basically the predecessors of a bridge series.
The joke when Payne's shows was that he would chop up one or two shows together to make a different show. Kind of Masick like, because his Gunbuster show was mixed in with Robotech Part 3. His conceit in that one was that Noriko was the little girl from Robotech, Next Generation, all grown up.
But wait, see, unfortunately, I managed to never catch Next Generation on television because I swear they got like halfway through Southern Cross or the Robotech Master Saga, and then they restarted the original. Like, I'm not sure if Toonami actually ever aired Next Generation.
Maybe not have, because Next Generation was when I saw Next Generation, it was on Channel 11 out of
It was St. probably Louis. The day, but by the time Toonami, the kids I knew that watched Robotech in my era, basically that second wave, we were familiar with Macross, and so a lot of them became Macross fans by extension, like myself. Yeah. So,
but the other Seishun Shitemasu that kind of touched on those was that he did. He did one of where he actually didn't cut much into it. He mostly did the first four episodes of Nadia cut up as Laputa 2.
I remember you've shown me that tape, like your fourth generation.
Yeah, it's fourth generation because somebody borrowed my original one that had all of them on it and lost it. So I'd have to do some really serious digging on the internet to find all of them because he had that terrible Ranma one, but Nadia 2 and the Ranma 1 3rd are probably the most famous. But he also did one for Gunbuster, and he did one for Kimagure Orange Road, the Akira story. This is what happens when you marry an Esper. And then there was they kind of established that, you know, before this, Anno was considered a really good animator. And then suddenly everybody was like, oh man, this guy he has director chops, too. Because not all great animators become great directors. But Anno really, this for his debut work, his fingerprints are all over it. All of his little quirks and touches and other things. And again, it's interesting to compare it to Royal Space Force. Because Royal Space Force has some great set pieces, but it's not nearly as interesting to watch as Gunbuster.
No, it's having watched through it several times, it's not nearly as compelling. It's still just mind-blowing that that's getting a sequel as well. When I heard that, I'm like, that's getting a sequel? So naturally, I was far less surprised when I saw that Gunbuster was getting a part 3.
Well, there's a lot of... Although they've been talking about sequels for a lot of these things for so long, I'll be amazed when one of them comes out. One of them will come out, but I wouldn't put any money as to which one will be first. But that's the story. That's how Gainax got their groove back. And this is where Anno sort of said, "Yes, I love giant robots."
If it wasn't for this, we wouldn't have Ava.
Yeah, definitely. They're a little bit, for one thing, Ava got that, you know what else Ava got from Gunbuster? Vending machines. There's scenes in the Exilion that are, it's the same row of vending machines that are in Nerve headquarters. Yeah. It's exactly the same row of vending machines.
Well, I think that just about wraps up our discussion on Gunbuster for this week. Join us for our next episode. We will be doing a follow-up episode of this at some point for Diebuster. But for what our next show is, we're not quite sure yet. So until next time, I've been Rick.
And I've been
Drew. Remember, someone had to draw that.